All right, here we go. Yesterday, you all sit with me?
Yeah.
Here we go. Yesterday, we really spoke about two different things. We spoke about, what did we speak about?
We spoke about the thing with Ben Gurion and
Germany.
Germany reparations, and we spoke about Unit 101.
Unit 101 was the thing with?
That, like, pre-Sarah Matkal, that Moshe Dayan set up, or Sharon red-led it, yeah. Where they did these retaliation raids. So that strike fear into the Arabs, teach them, don't even think of starting up again.
And then they Sharon was an anti-Arab?
What?
I thought Sharon was like an anti-settlement.
Sharon, first of all, he was a soldier.
Is Ari Sharon an idiot president?
He was the prime minister.
Well, the one that you get to Kush Katib, that one?
That one.
I hate that guy.
Okay. I would say feel the same, but he's dead. Anyway, Ariel Sharon is an interesting person. I'll have time to speak about him over the course of these classes. But he was a soldier who was a hero in Israel, to the point that people would sing Arik Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. He was not part of labor, and that's why he was passed over. Golda Meir asked Moshe Dayan, "Is he one of us?" And the answer was no, and therefore he wasn't given the job as the chief of staff. He goes into politics. He originally is very right-wing, and when he becomes prime minister, he then switches his tune and he gives away Gush Katif. I quoted him saying,
"Gush Katif was like he gave away other settlements also."
Right, all settlements in Gaza and in Chomesh, like in Shamra. His line was, "Not sure in." Mishama lower in Mikan. Right? You guys are judging, and it's easier for you, but you don't see what I see from the prime ministers. See. And I'm sure there's a lot of truth to that. I'm sure that's true for every prime minister, that we don't know what kind of international pressure is being put upon a person, or let's say not international, even just like from the United States, who's supposed to be our ally and gives us lots of weapons or loans and all sorts of stuff like that. Where pressure is put upon them, and it's hard to say no.
Trump doesn't give away parts of America because people pressure him.
I'm not saying yes, no. I'm just saying it's very easy to not be in that seat. You know, we spoke yesterday about Ben-Gurion, and you also said, "Oh, Ben-Gurion's not." Okay. I just read an article in the Arutz Sheva internet site last night. This guy Ron Jager was saying that Ben-Gurion used practicality, and sometimes said we have to do what's practical, even if it's not idealistic. So first we had the German migration, but even before that, when the state was formed, you had the revisionists by Jabotinsky saying, "Is that all there to show? Why would we partition any land of Israel?" And Ben Gurion felt sometimes we have to be practical, take what we can get, hopefully it'll get better, and it did. So he was writing it about Trump's deal of the century. So you have people in the right wing saying yes to sovereignty, no to Palestinian state. In other words, they're picking apart Trump's peace deal. Anything that's pro-Israel, yes to. And those pro-Arabs, say no to and have a hard line, we'll only do what's good for Israel. And this guy was writing and saying sometimes you have to be, you know, practical. Or there's a bumper sticker that's popular in Israel, Tieh Chacham Lo Al Tieh Tzodek. Don't be right, don't just be smart. Right? Yes, that guy cut you off. So you could now go and do road rage, you know, run him down and do all sorts of stuff. And what's going to come of that? Right? So don't be tzodek, don't be right, be chacham. This is sort of what this guy was writing. And his opinion was, accept the peace deal. I'm not saying we should or we shouldn't. I'm just saying this idea of being practical is more Ben-Gurion style. It certainly wasn't the style of the ideologue Menachem Begin, or lots of ideologues, whether it be right wing or left wing. Right? So that is, you know, in any country, basically what you have. The majority of the people are in the center, but you have extremists on both sides. And it's, like I said, it's easy to be an extremist when you're not in a position of power. Menachem Begin, who was, you know, the biggest right wing opponent of the Ben-Gurion government, he's the one that made a peace treaty with Egypt and gave away the entire Sinai, including Yamit, where there was like this beautiful Israeli Okay? So to sit there and say, I'm just saying, it makes sense that we don't always see what's going on. And people do the best they can. That's what I say all the time. And I give this class, a lot of times I'll point out what I think are failures that we've had along the way. The people will say to me, so what should be this? And I have no idea. I have no idea. I don't think I know better than anyone else. I'm just pointing out where we've made a mistake. And one of my favorite quotes that I once had this book of quotations, Wordsworth book of quotations, it's a great bathroom book. You know, it's just like, oh, great quotes. Churchill has some of my favorites. But one quote that I loved was, the only thing we learn from history is that we never learn from history. Okay? I think it's a very powerful quote. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to point out where we went wrong. What?
Is it Churchill?
He didn't say that. No. He had a lot of great quotes. That wasn't one of them. I don't remember who said it. But it's a great quote. And that's what I'm trying to say. We should at least look and see, look, this hasn't worked in the past. Right? What's Einstein's definition of insanity?
Doing something at the same time.
Doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Right? So that's what I sometimes feel that we do. This has failed so many times in the past. There's some reason we think now it's going to work. So that's what I'm doing. I'm pointing out where I think there might have been mistakes. I'm not saying I know better. Right? The interesting thing about Trump's peace plan is that he didn't just try to rehash every single peace plan that's been presented by the United States since 1969, when the Secretary of State, Dan Rogers, basically said, okay, Israel, make all these concessions and the Arabs will then let you live. Which is basically what every other peace plan said. And now Trump, you know, turned it around. So, okay. It's a breath of fresh air. Will it work? No idea. But at least it's different.
What's the status right now on that? Is anything that move forward?
No.
I don't really get what it is.
From what I understood, but you can look it up. From what I understood, Trump is saying that Israel should have sovereignty over all the areas in Judea, Samaria, Yudah, Shomron, where Jews live.
About where Arabs.
Okay, and they'll do a land transfer. They will give an Arab state to Arabs in the parts that are populated by Arabs. It's sort of like with the United Nations in 1947. But that will include some areas in Israel proper, right? That will include up in the Galilee. This is like triangle where there's a lot of Arabs. That will become part of the Arab state. That will include, obviously, Gaza, but also the land, let's say, Gush Etzion, where I live. So that's Jewish population, that will become part of Israel. So all the different areas, however much land that is, they will then create in the Negev, which is unpopulated, an Arab, you know, give from what's Israel proper to the Arabs. And they'll have some sort of super speed underground railroad that will connect the different Arab states, you know, parts of the state, and people will be able to travel and this like this whole thing with tons and tons of financial incentives. Sort of saying, if you really care about the Palestinian people, the Palestinian economy, you don't want to live in poverty, this is your way out. You'll get statehood, which is what you want. He said, forget about what we've been discussing yesterday, the Palestinian refugees. That's not happening. Okay? Be practical. We're going to help you with your economy. I'm going to create a state. And it was rejected outright by the Palestinians.
They don't actually care about the economy.
Or it was rejected outright.
Palestinians rejected now?
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing about it is he said, they basically, everyone knew that that would happen right away. And the question was, will they then come back and negotiate? But the interesting thing about it was that Israel has the right, if the Palestinians reject, to apply already sovereignty on all the places. Up until now, every peace plan would say, Israel has to free settlements and Israel can never annex this thing. Even when Israel annexed the Golan, America doesn't recognize it. You know? I don't think they recognize that Israel annexed the Golan when Begin did it in the 80s. So here it is, you have America saying, go ahead and annex Gush Etzion, Modi, in all these areas, these large settlement areas. And that's part of the Jewish state. And if the Arabs want to get around to doing stuff, we can talk. But they're not going to get their incentives. And this is already, we don't have to wait till they agree, till you annex. Annex right away. So some of this is what's due today. And Jared Kushner was saying, wait until after the elections, Israel's election, which is in less than a month. So whether or not people are going to wait or not going to wait, because you have people saying, who knows who's going to come to government? Maybe they'll say, we won't annex. You know? So that's the debate that's going on amongst politicians today.
Need to annex is already, according to Israel, it's already part of Israel.
But it's not officially part of the Jewish part of, like, it's still considered. I live in an area that is run by the army, because it's not part of Israel proper, it's part of the West Bank.
So now it would be Israel.
Yeah. I mean, for a while, we're talking about making Gush Etzion part of Yerushalayim.
It's not going to be checkpoints?
I don't know. I don't know all the details.
Sorry.
I read a synopsis, obviously a humongously long thing. I read a synopsis. Anyway.
Are you allowed to vote?
Am I allowed to vote?
Yeah.
On what? In the elections?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm an Israeli citizen. I voted dozens of times. In this country, we have elections every 3 months. This is the third time we're having elections this year.
Why?
Because Israel couldn't form. Okay, I'll take time out on this. Ready? Okay, let me explain. Manuel, ready? Here we go. Let me just explain how the Israeli government works.
He wants to know why it's jurisdicted by the army. And like, what's the difference between that and...
It's not recognized by the international community as being part of Israel. Like I said, I don't think they recognize the Golan Heights either. Israel annexed it, and they made it part of Israel. They have not yet annexed where I live. It's still considered, what the international community calls the West Bank, or what others call Yehuda v'Shomron.
It's really being in the West Bank
now? You could tell where a person is holding politically by how he refers to the area. If he calls it the illegal occupied, you're ready, no right. But even if you call it, the West Bank, it's different than Yehuda v'Shomron. Yehuda v'Shomron is saying this is biblical heartland of Israel. And David Friedman, who is the American ambassador to Israel, is a firm Jew who, before he did this, was a big supporter of Beit El. And he is definitely involved. His son studied here in Yeshiva. And he's definitely a big supporter of Yehuda v'Shomron. And that's why part of this was drawn up, saying this is biblical heartland of Israel. Why would it ever be negotiated?
But
the West Bank, it's just, was Jordan conquered in 48? Israel got back in 67? It's just territory. But for other people, Shiloh, this has way more biblical significance than Tel Aviv and Haifa. Yeah, I mentioned in Tanakh, right? So why would we ever negotiate away Beit El, Shiloh, Hebron?
You mentioned in like Lech Lecha, no?
Yeah, this is the biblical heartland. Now, just as far as elections, since we have one coming up in a month, I'll just give you a rundown now. The way that Israel works is, there are 120 Knesset members. Why 120? What? Anshei Knesset Agdola. Good. We have 120 members of the Anshei Knesset Agdola. Okay. When we came back and built up by a chain. Okay. It's just a story. Israel. Stop doing that. It's just okay. When we came back and built up by a chain, led by Ezra Nehemiah, we set up. It's different than the base in Agdola, which had 71, and Anshei Knesset Agdola, 120, elders. Okay. And it's referenced all over the place. Anshei Knesset Agdola did so many things that makes our religion, something that we take granted, the sitters from Anshei Knesset Agdola. There's a whole bunch of things done by Anshei Knesset Agdola. Now, we came back, so they said, okay, let's form our parliament. We'll call it the Knesset. The Anshei Knesset Agdola of 120 seats. Okay. Now, what Israel has, which most of you guys would not understand because it's not the American system, is you have many different parties that run. And if you pass, and it's a population. So if let's say 25% of the population votes for one party, so you'll get 30 seats. 25% out of 120. You have 30 seats in the Knesset. Right? If 50% vote for you, you have 60 seats in the Knesset. Okay, what you should know, no party, including in Ben-Gurion's heyday, ever got by itself more than 56 seats. And therefore, ever since the formation of the state, there's always been some sort of parties joining together to form a coalition. Once you have that, there's always politicking.
That's what they want to do with...
And that's what's going on all the time.
Right.
So now, let's say I need you. Okay? I've got 50 seats. Recently, no one gets more than like 35. So I need 50 seats. I'm David Ben-Gurion back in the heyday. But I need Alex's 12 seats. Alex has no libero. You know, I've got so many more seats. But he says, look, you can't form a government without me. So I'll... This is what I want in return. I want A, B, and C.
And
I'm going like, what? I'm going to make you the defense minister.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you this. I'm going to give this. I have five times more seats than you. All right? You don't want it? Fine. You know? So that's what politics is all about. So you have, for example, you have recently, the last, let's say, I don't know, five elections, some groups that run on one issue. Okay? And they're very easily bought. So, for example, you'll have the legalized marijuana party. Okay? And they say, you know, vote for us, and we'll get marijuana legalized. We'll call it the Green Leaf Party.
We'll just hold the vote.
The Green Leaf Party. They run the election.
Both people in the...
No. So let's say, again, in order to get a seat in the Knesset, they raise the threshold that basically you need to get four seats. So at 3.25%. You need to get four seats, otherwise all your votes are wasted. I'll explain that in a second. But the people who, let's say, are running in the Green Leaf Party, they say, okay, vote for us because we're so mellow, we don't really care what the government does, you know, we're always high, and we can join any party. So we just go over to whether it's the right-wing party or the left-wing party, and we say, you want our four seats? No problem. You just give me an assurance that you'll legalize marijuana, and we will vote however you tell us to vote on any other issue. Because we don't care about any other issue. Right?
Wait,
so far they haven't gotten in. Right? But that's their platform. That platform is, as long as you legalize marijuana, we will vote however you tell us. So you have a whole bunch of weird parties, different parties, you know, men's rights. What does that mean? Oh, women... They've got so many, like, you know, women's rights stuff that now we men, we feel that we're being oppressed. So we need now vote for men so that we should also have some rights. You know, you've got the weirdest parties that run.
Is there a religious unit? I mean, religious?
There's a lot of different religious parties. We have a lot of different religious parties, which makes it also problematic.
All these parties come into two main parties or something?
Okay, so now, as I said, you'll have, for the most part, let's say there'll be, I don't know, 25, 30 parties that will run, only about 10, maybe even less, will have enough votes to actually make it into the Knesset. All the rest of the parties, some of them jokes, will get like a few thousand votes and it'll just be wasted votes. Okay, so at the end, let's say we have 100,000 wasted votes.
You can only vote for...
One party. Okay? I vote for one party. Let's say I vote for the marijuana party, and they don't get it. Right. I do it for my students. I want my students to say, Aliyah, this is the way I'm going to get this thing. Come here. Okay, now, that's what my son used to say when he was a teacher. He said, make Aliyah, legal drinking age, 18. Anyway, so...
There's so many things to vote for. Like
you're right.
You're right.
That's a big thing. Now, most parties have multiple issues, and they'll have a whole platform. And they'll say, this is how I feel about education, this is how I feel about religion, this is how I feel about territory, this is how I feel about economy, this is how I feel about... And you have to read through, and you see which is to your liking. And they will tell you what, you know, any major party has to have a say on any major thing. Right? So the major parties, because eventually they're also saying, I'm going to run the country my way. The biggest thing that started, one of the biggest fights in the beginning of the country was, capitalism versus communism. It was economy. Economy, it was like, how should I run the country? And when Begin took over and the country became capitalistic, that was a huge change. Beforehand, it was like basically what? Communist socialism, right? That's the way the people did it. You should know, just the mere fact, this is a very crazy thing to think about it. The fact that these people came, Jews came from all over the world, and started a country and made it democratic is remarkable because most of the Jews who came from non-democratic countries.
Yeah.
certainly all the Sfarim.
And satellite.
The Sfarim that came, not the democratic countries, and a lot of the Europeans, depending on what country you're in.
Under Russia.
Right? They weren't democratic. So it's like we take it for granted because we grew up in American democracy, and like, oh, Israel's like America, it's not democratic. But it's not a given at all that the people go. It's not like they came, that's the way they grew up. We grew up in a democratic country, so we expect to come to a democratic country. Most of the people that came did not come from democratic countries. So it's really somewhat remarkable that they did this.
It's the same thing now that when they were forming America, like they were like so like scared of what happened in absolute power in England.
You're right. I'm not saying there's not logical reasons, but I'm just saying like I didn't think about it until I listened to it. I know it was from Woodmere, but there's a guy, Rabbi Hoffman, Evan Hoffman, I think he's a rabbi in New Rochelle, but he gives classes out of the Young Israel of Woodmere, adult education classes. And he's into politics, and he gave classes on the state of Israel for politics. And he went through every election. He went through every party, what every party like held, what was their thing. He went through their campaigns. He like talked about what their billboards were, what their slogans were. It was very interesting, very technical. But he pointed out this idea that the fact that it's democracy is not a given. And I never thought about it. Right? And I said, wow, that is something. But anyway, democracy... so now, the parties will go like this. Let's say you have the two main parties. Anyone know what the two main parties are in this country right now, according to the polls?
Kahol
Levan and Likud.
Likud.
Okay. And the leader of Kahol Levan is? Benny Gantz and Likud.
Bibi.
Okay. So Netanyahu has now been prime minister longer than any person, even he passed Ben-Gurion. Okay? I don't recall right now, but he's now logged more time as prime minister than anyone.
But you're not staying prime minister for as long as you...
Yeah. Unlike in the United States, we don't do two terms. There's no such thing. Not only that, you can lose it and come back. Ben-Gurion was prime minister, he left, he came back. Bibi was prime minister, he left, he came back. You could lose an election and win the next election.
Wait, Ben-Gurion was a socialist, by the way?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, now...
He started the country like communistic?
Socialism. Yeah.
What's the difference between socialism?
Social and communism are very similar. It's an ideology versus a practicality, but it's pretty much, it's similar. Yeah.
So it's
you can go Google, it's one of the more common things. It's between socialism and communism. You'll look it up. Yeah. Yes, sir, you should always say.
Is it Israel might have needed that at the beginning?
Yeah, they might have.
Start up.
They might have. Look. So now, the way that the country works like this, people vote. So let's say a quarter of the country votes for Likud and a quarter votes for blue and white. So each one gets 30. You can't do anything with 30. Okay? Now what they can do, let's say they get 32 and 32. What they can do is do a national unity government. Just the two of them, two parties, they don't need anyone else. They already have 64. And that's possible. And that could have already been done in the second election and in the first election.
What do you think? Do what with them? Do we join parties?
To merge.
To merge?
But they have totally different opinions. Though.
Oh, okay. But they're both in the center. They're not polar opposites. Okay? It is a possibility. I think it's a probability in the next election even that you merge. And they don't need any little parties. They can do it all by themselves. They don't need any little parties. But let's say you don't want to merge. Say what the problem was for blue and white. Problem was, Benny Gantz is a no-name person. He's never been in politics. All we know is that he was the Ramatkal. He was the chief of staff in the army. Okay, so good. He was a good soldier, and he became chief of staff. Does he have any experience as a politician? Zero. Do we know how he stands on any issues? Not really. Why did so many people vote for Benny Gantz? It's the anti-Bibi vote. That's the platform they ran on. They ran on, Bibi is corrupt, we need to replace Bibi. So now they're stuck, because the only way they can get into power is they're doing what? Join together if they could. But how do they tell their voters that they now kept Bibi in power? And they'll rotate, you know, 2 years, Gantz will be prime minister 2 years, Netanyahu, which is what was being suggested in the last thing, when they told their voters, we're running to get rid of Bibi. So now we're going to merge with Bibi? we disappoint our electorate. That is where they were stuck. And therefore, they tried to make an alliance with all the other parties, as diddly could, and no one was able to get enough votes. Why? Because of Avigdor Lieberman. Avigdor Lieberman is the kingpin. He's the kingmaker. He had about 10 seats, and he said, I don't want the country to be blackmailed by either the far right or the far left. What this government needs is a middle government of Likud and blue and white together. I'll only, go along if both of them go along. And then he makes himself sound very magnanimous because he says, I don't even need a position. I'm not doing it for my ego. I don't have to be given any ministry. I feel that what the country needs is a country of moderates, the two moderate opinions, the big party, Likud and blue and white. Let them go together, and I'll give my blessing, and we'll have the requisite number of seats. But once again, blue and white stuck, and Ruby Rivlin, who's the president, spent days and days trying to work out compromises, even telling Benny Gantz, look, the minute Netanyahu is indicted, he's out. If they actually indict him, he's no longer prime minister, and you're just prime minister. It could be a short amount of time. Again, it's hard for him to go back to the electorate and say, Bibi can be prime minister at all when I ran on the anti-Bibi platform. And that's what happened. Election one, election two, and now we're up to election three.
It's going to happen again.
What's to do with the Hasidim?
It's very hard.
Hasidim, all the issues within the state.
There are religious parties. The religious parties, for the most part, are more right-wing. Bibi, before the negotiating, already formed a 55-man alliance between his party and all the religious parties, so that together with 55, so that he couldn't be. He's very smart. He's a whatever you want to say about Bibi, you can't say he's not a good politician. He knows politics. So Bibi said, if I go into my negotiations, I am at a deficit, because after the last election, blue and white, if I remember correctly, had 34 seats. And like we could at 32. So, they have the upper hand. But now it's, no, I'm not 32. I'm a coalition of 55 seats. Negotiate with me as a leader of 55 seats. Right? And this way, blue and white wasn't able to pull away, other people, because they're already part of the coalition. What will happen in third? Yeah, what do you want to say?
I have a question.
Yeah, ask.
What's your opinion on the B'nai Brak protest that happened yesterday?
What happened?
You see the videos of the police
Pulling
the buffer.
I think it is a humongous chilashem. Okay, I'll explain for those who don't know. Okay, I actually once gave a shiur, and I think it's on YU Torah, Army versus Kolam, because I got so upset a few years ago. You had some rabbanim coming out saying going to the army is Yaro V'al Yavor, right? Better to be killed. Like Yehor Hashiva Stamina Bodhisa, right? Better to be killed than going to the army. And therefore you have this very extreme Haredi faction. They call themselves the Jerusalem faction, Peleg HaYerushalmi, who was led by Shmuel Orbach, son of Shmuel Zalman Orbach, that not only is it's not enough for us that the army gives a dispensation to yeshiva guys. That's not enough. We don't want to have to go to the office and file for dispensation. We want it to be automatic. The same way the army doesn't draft Arabs into the army.
It's a security.
No kidding, Sherlock. The same way that they shouldn't draft us. Why should they draft us? We are outside of even, the public. And therefore, anyone who's drafted, they don't bother showing up. They won't go to the office and file, we want a dispensation because we're learning in yeshiva, which is readily granted. They don't show up. Then what happens? The police will come and arrest the guy as a draft dodger. And then they go berserk. Get your hands off of him. And then they start fighting with the police. They close down traffic. Right? They stop. There was a story last year they showed in the news. Some bride couldn't get to her wedding because they closed down the traffic. and you see this bride in her white gown walking through the streets carrying stuff because she couldn't get to her wedding. It's terrible. I mean, it's absolutely awful. I think it's a huge failure. What?
Is it just...
Okay. They sit in front of the light rail.
Yeah.
I know.
Slowly driving the movie.
It's... No, they don't.
The
they don't.
So they get run over.
Yeah. And then they stop the light rail. They stop the traffic. They do all these things. I think it's awful. I was very upset at a lot of the Kol guys in our yeshiva, because these guys, I've driven them home. They all tell me, oh, it gives us a bad name. Everyone thinks that just because we look Haredi, we're part of them, and we're not like them. And yet, when Shmuel Orbach passed away, all these Kol guys left the Beis Medrash and went to the Leviathan. They went to honor him. I said, I don't get it. You told me that Zichir Hashem is giving you a bad name, and now you all left. Rabino was in America at the time, he wasn't here. I said to some guys, I think you guys should forfeit your Kol paycheck for today. I am sure that Rabino does not think it's okay that you just like leave. You're supposed to be paid here to learn. Instead, you went to a Labaya? I think it was wrong.
I don't get how they get paid to learn here. What does that mean?
It's like an academic scholarship. People get scholarships to go off and study science or whatever, because great things will come, you know, from this science. From this person and his endeavors in science, so there's an academic scholarship to continue your learning, so you become a big Talmud Chacham.
So
that's the idea of Kol.
What do you think should be done to stop these protests from that? Like, do you think there should be like a law in like place or anything like that?
What?
Like, do you think that? What do you think should be done? Like, do you think these people deserve to be arrested?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think anything should be like? Like a law should be put in place that...
Look, I mean, the army gives a dispensation that they can't be bothered to fill out a form.
Right.
Will they close down traffic? It's not like... I'm not even so happy with the fact that the army gives a dispensation, personally. I think it's ridiculous. You know, Ben-Gurion made a deal with the Chazon Ish.
400.
And now it's like 55,000 or more. You know, and by the year 2050, according to the sociologists, the majority, I mean, not the majority, 50% of the Jewish population in Israel will be Haredi. So you know what that means? It means 50% of the country will be supporting the other 50%, because they're not in the workplace, and 50% will be protecting the other 50%, they're not in the army. Like, what's going on here?
What is it?
You guys are protesting. What
about sharing the burden? Right? I have to work. These people, they're not giving back to society. They're living on welfare. Like, why? I don't get it. Now, I have no problem, just like an academic, having the elite. I think there should be elite people. They shouldn't go in the army. They shouldn't be, you know, like, oh, what would Chas v'Shalom would happen to Rav Yosef, because as a young 17, 18-year-old, he got killed in an army accident. Okay, so you have the elite of the elite. There should be tests, and they should be say, okay, these people are elite, the same way you have for certain gifted academic scholars, right? And that Israel has for people who are gifted musicians or gifted athletes, because they say these type of things that oh, they give pride to the country. They're going to be in the Olympics, so whatever it is. So Israel, I think we should care about Torah.
I agree,
but I don't know. You need 55,000-60,000 people, you know, being exempt?
Agreed, but what do you think is going to happen after they go to the army? Well, then they're just going to go back to learning, and then the other half is going to have to support them anyways.
So, I think it's like this. I'm saying, like, I think there's a problem, I think, with the whole mindset here. I started speaking about it a little bit on Friday night, but in the United States, I'll say quickly. In the United States, I'd say about 90% of the Haredim in America, right-wing, you know, yeshivish people, by the time they're their late 20s, are working, you know? Maybe 10% are sitting in a kol their whole lives, like in a late one. But by the time you hit 30, most people are working, supporting their families. That's so good. You want to sit in yeshiva until you're 25, 26 before you get a job? No problem. Right? I think there is something one of my students who went to the Mir after he was here, he said, it's interesting, like, he's with all these yeshivish guys in the Mir, American yeshivish guys. He said, where I come from, not Orthodox community, so it's expected, you go to yeshiva after high school for a year or two. Three already is pushing it. And all the kids in the yeshivish world, it's expected you go 4 or 5 years. And then you go look for a job, or maybe you go get a quick training in a college, you know, med school, something like that. But you first want 4 or 5 years, at least, right? Why is it that we don't care enough about Torah that everybody's shana bet parents are freaking out, depending where you come, which community you're from. And shana gimel, even in the other communities, they freak out. But he says in the yeshivish world, and say like as most students, like the Brooklyn, Queens community, so like of course you learn 5 or 6 years after high school to continue learning. And then you go off to get a job, but you're a bit of a Talmud Chacham and you continue learning while you are an accountant or, you know, a tax attorney or a business, whatever you're doing, but you learn. Most of the people from our community who learn certainly just for a year, they're not even learning after on when they hit 30. It's a big deal if they stay in for the rabbi's speech, you know. Some just go out for a kid's club, you know. So there is something that's wrong with our community. But I like the American Haredi approach, that you learn 5, 6 years, whatever, and you continue to learn the rest of your life, but you get a job. Here's the opposite. 90% of the people are in kola. And if you work, you look down upon. Oh, your father works for a living? We're not going to let you into our cheder, because your father's not really stark enough. Because stark people, they just learn their whole life. Your dad's working, so nebuch, it's not really fun.
That's what it's become.
It's terrible. I think it's terrible. My opinion. It could be, you ask other rabbis here, they'll disagree with me. My opinion. Right? I think that's terrible. But I think, I have no problem with select few. I've had arguments from Demoni that said, I don't get it. I just go teach. Now, Demoni, he has the Sparty party, this and this stuff. Like, there are guys in the Kol that have been in the Kol ever since I started teaching here 20 years ago. They're not teaching. They're not writing. They're just learning. You know, in the academic world, if you want to continue to get your scholarship, your grant, you have to be publishing something.
What does he say? What does Rav Ramani say?
He said to me, oh, if you had a research like I had, you'd understand why I keep learning. All due respect. That's an answer for me. That's not an answer for me.
Yeah, but
let's say that's great for you. It's not good for Klal Yisrael. Great. You're learning great. I'm so happy for you. So give back to Klal Yisrael. There might be guys sitting in our kol, certainly in other kolos, with so much to offer, but they're learning and learning and learning. Oh, it's like, yeah, no, I'm not going to give back. So let's even say, I want to be a dayan. I can't just learn 3 years, you know, 4 years.
Your answer is going to be like, when I learn, it gives back to Klal Yisrael.
I know. And that's a mystical answer that I can't argue with, but I don't like it. I don't like it. I'm just saying, that's me personally.
At the same time, though,
like, right? And that'll be their mystical answer. Who knows? I'm supporting clients. My learning is saving lives in the battlefield. Okay, you know what? You know, in the Torah, we say, go to war. We don't say, everyone pick up the helmet and read. David HaMelech, who wrote the helmet, fought battles. He didn't say, okay, everyone open up the capital, cook for your test.
That's why
he fought. I know. Everywhere you look, people are fighting. All of a sudden, now it's different. I have a problem.
The biggest thing that you're going to do is
today.
Yeah.
Today right now.
Yeah.
Yaakov.
I'm just saying, like, what they love quoting is the end of the Rambam. Rambam says we should be like Sheva Lady. Sheva Lady didn't have to fight. We can, anyone, if there's something
like
Sheva Lady, and ends with a pasuk. Ends with a pasuk that anyone could dedicate themselves like a Shbarach. They always forget to look who wrote that pasuk. David HaMelech. David had no problem fighting and dedicating himself to a Shbarach. It's not a steerer. Anyway, we'll stop over here, and I have no idea what to call this.